evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C. It's Friday, October 11th of 2019, and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. It's Friday, so that means it's panel time, and we're joined by a man with a PhD in political economy. He teaches economics and politics at St. Mary's College in California and is the author of the forthcoming book, The Scourge of Neoliberalism, U.S. Policy from Reagan to Trump, Dr. Jack Rasmus. Jack, as always, welcome back.
Good evening.
Good evening, sir. We're also joined by a political analyst, commentator, and editor of The Polemicist. His latest article is Dead Man's Hand, The Impeachment Gambit, Jim Kavanaugh. Jim, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thanks for having me, Dr. Leon.
Well, let's start. Trump delays tariff increase for China, citing substantial phase one deal. President Donald Trump said today that the U.S. and China have reached what he called a substantial phase one deal, in which Beijing agreed to limited measures to improve trade ties between the countries. In exchange, the president will not move forward with another round of tariff increases against roughly $250 billion in Chinese goods that had been set to take effect this coming Tuesday. Dr. Jack Rasmus, we spoke, I want to say, might have been yesterday. And you were fairly certain that a minimal deal would be reached, that victory would be claimed, and that when you look at the details, there's not a whole lot there. Dr. Jack Rasmus, your thoughts?
Yes, and I've also been predicting for almost a year now that if they struck any kind of deal, there would be no agreement over next-generation technology issues, which have always been the core of these negotiations. And if there were a deal, Trump would take the money and run and abandon the tech issue here in order to get some recommitment of China purchasing farm goods. And that's exactly what this, quote, phase one is about. Phase one here is still just a verbal agreement, got to be understood, that any kind of written finalization will take another 5 weeks at least. Trump has indicated he might sign it off at the APEC meeting in Chile with President Xi. What's in this thing? Well, farm purchases. He's hyped it as $40 billion, but he hasn't said over what period. And it is not clear how much now. How much in 2020, how much in 2021, because it's over 2 years, first of all. So it is a farm purchase agreement, kind of like the focus of the Japan-U.S. agreement of last week. There is an agreement for U.S. Banks and financial services company to own 51% of their operations in China. Well, that's been on the table, offered by China for over a year now, so that's not new. And that was there for the taking at any time, as well as more farm goods, because the Chinese last year promised $1 trillion over 5 years of farm purchases. Tariffs, important issue here. The existing tariffs will still exist. Planned tariffs further on $160 billion of consumer goods for December, still there. The only thing taken off the table was a 5% increase on existing tariffs that were due next week. There's an agreement on a currency. In other words, China will not allow its currency to devalue, which would offset the tariffs, of course. But China has not been doing that for over a year and a half and has no plans to do that anyway for reasons of its own. So he didn't get anything that was already there on the currency. He didn't get anything on the financial services that already been offered. He didn't get anything on the farm stuff that purchases that was already offered. And most important, no agreement, i.e. China's position on next-gen technologies. And the U.S. will apparently continue to go after Huawei and other Chinese corporations. So what's really been achieved here? I don't see that much, really, that wasn't already on the table or wasn't really an issue. China's always been calling for a partial deal, and apparently it got the partial deal. Trump has always been calling for the big deal to include tech. He didn't get it. Who caved in?
Who caved in? And in terms of farm purchases, I've always understood for the last few months that a lot of the markets have already gone to Brazil and other countries for China. So when the president starts hailing agreements to buy product, are the markets coming back? What's going on?
We'll have to see. I don't know. I mean, clearly this is politically, it sounds to me like, I hadn't seen this deal today. I was just listening to what Jack said. Politically, it sounds like that point of it is to get some money into the Midwestern farmers again from China. And I don't know whether they'll come back. You know, if China has agreed to actually buy more American products, then some money will come back just in time for the election to the Midwestern farmers. So that seems to me to be the main thing I hear in this. You know, as Jack said, they've deferred again the issue of the next-gen tech, which is a big issue. I don't like to hear that the Chinese, with that said, Jack says they already were willing to do that, are willing to give up American financial institutions 51%. But these are all things, you know, that were part of deals that were on the table anyway. So it seems to me, I don't see any big winners and losers here. As Jack says, in the sense that Trump is keep saying, I'm going to get a big deal, you know, the greatest deal you've ever seen. Well, this is not that. This is kind of freezing things at the status quo where they are and deferring things till past the election.
We're now also joined by a frequent collaborator with all major news outlets and author of City Builders and Vandals in Our Age, Caleb Maupin. Caleb, thank you. Sounds like President Xi gave Trump the sleeves off his vest, and it'll be interesting to see how U.S. media explains this so-called deal.
Indeed. There's so much about this, but the more you look at this, it seems very much like Trump created a problem and then solved the problem he created and is going to try and want credit for that among the U.S. public. You know, you start a trade war with the second largest economy in the world's biggest producer of steel, the country that's making huge breakthroughs in computer technology and has the world's fastest supercomputers, the fastest trains. You start a trade war with one of the fastest growing economies on the planet. It causes all kinds of problems for farm exports and all kinds of, you know, areas of our economy. It throws growth around the world into question, and it makes a kind of a nervous motion on the market. And then you resolve it somehow. You reach understanding, and you say, "See, I solved the problem." You know, it's like lighting someone's house on fire and then putting it out and saying that you're a hero. You know, he solved a problem he created. But how solved is it really, right? I mean, as we heard from the previous speakers, there's still a lot that has to be resolved. This isn't the end. This is a step toward possibly ending the tension. But, you know, Huawei is still being targeted. A lot of tariffs are remaining in place. So we will have to see what comes out of this. No doubt Trump is going to try and present himself as a big winner here.
Ousted Ambassador Marie Yovanovitch tells Congress Trump pressured State Department to remove her. The former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, whose abrupt ouster in May has become a focus of House impeachment investigators, said today that her departure came as a direct result of pressure President Trump placed on the State Department to remove her, according to her prepared remarks before Congress. She told lawmakers that she was forced to leave Kiev on the next plane this past spring and subsequently removed from her post, with the State Department's number two official telling her that although she had done nothing wrong, the president had lost confidence in her and the agency had been under significant pressure to remove her since 2018. Jim Kavanaugh, what are we to make of her testimony?
Well, you know, the Democrats are full on this campaign to impeach Trump. She's someone who has, you know, I don't know what to say about this. This is the kind of thing that any president might do. Okay, they have someone they think is not following their agenda in a country who's an ambassador, might get rid of them. Now, whatever Trump's agenda was here, you know, it might have been to find, get dirt on Joe Biden. It might have been a difference of opinion about what to do about Ukraine. You know, we are creating a situation in which, you know, is every decision, this is going to keep going on. Republicans aren't, you know, this is going to switch. Republicans are going to do this to the Democrats. I guarantee you, every decision that's made by the president is going to be oversighted and overlooked. They're calling witnesses and they're, you know, and these guys, ambassador and the Yovanovitch and the guy Volker, they are, you know, you've got to look at what's happened in Ukraine. Unfortunately, Trump doesn't even understand this. He doesn't know what he's doing, I don't think. But the situation in Ukraine and the government in Ukraine, which was put in there by the United States, and what the agenda is there is unclear to everybody. So Trump has his own agenda, and it's you know, kind of half-assed. But we now have a situation where people who are against him are going to come out and be subpoenaed, and they're going to be done. This is a horrible thing against our democracy. But this is what every president does. They put people in ambassadorships who follow their orders.
Caleb Maupin, ambassadors, to Jim's point, serve at the will of the president. And in explaining her departure, she acknowledged months of criticisms from Giuliani, who had accused her of privately bad-mouthing the president and seeking to protect the interests of former Vice President Joe Biden and his son, who served on the board of a Ukrainian energy company. She denied those allegations and said that she was incredulous that her superiors decided to remove her based on, quote, unfounded and false claims by people with clearly questionable motives, end quote. She also took direct aim at Giuliani's associates, whom she said would have been financially threatened by her anti-corruption efforts in Ukraine. But again, Caleb, ambassadors serve at the will of the president.
Indeed. You know, you have to, you know, unpack this from a couple different layers here. When you talk about Obama and Russia and Eastern Europe, it's pretty clear that the Obama administration was in with this faction that, you know, maybe this is not the best term to use. It's become a word that has taken on so much different meanings, but the neocon faction of, you know, people like John Bolton, people who, you know, studied Sovietology at American universities, learned to speak Russian, became experts on all the communist internationals, and saw the Reagan administration as kind of the height of their political ideology, Gene Kirkpatrick, et cetera. There's a, you know, kind of a faction in the U.S. Foreign Service and in the U.S. diplomatic corps and in the intelligence agencies and in different sections of the U.S. government and the U.S. power structure that it was grouped around a certain way of viewing, you know, the former Soviet Union in particular and, you know, advocates of use of force in foreign policy and such. And this is a faction that existed, and Obama did clash with them. And it's not like Republicans versus Democrats. It's more complicated than that. And it appears that you know, that Trump, for better or for worse, has had, you know, a very, very hostile relationship with these folks, even though they continue to show up in his administration, right? Bolton was national security advisor for a long time before he was removed, and that while Trump plays ball with these people sometimes, he also seems to have a clash with them. And it seemed like, especially when it came to issues with Ukraine and with Russia, Obama was all about these folks, all about that particular faction. Trump doesn't have as much of a good relationship with them. You know, I think the fact that Trump is being constantly accused of, you know, collaborating with Russia and the collusion and the investigation and the things that Trump has said on the campaign trail about not wanting to meddle in foreign policy, which is, you know, and not believing in regime change, which is one of these folks' central theses, that one of the main things they advocate doing. It's complicated. It's not all in front of our faces either. It's not all public knowledge, but there is a struggle going on. There is one faction, and the Obama administration really liked working with them in Eastern Europe, in Ukraine, and in regards to Russia. The Trump administration does so. If they do so, it's reluctant. They're not happy to work with these folks. They don't trust these folks. And I think that's what's playing out here. And, you know, I mean, you know, diplomats serve at the president's wishes, right? Ambassadors, that's up to the president. So, but the fact that this is being turned into a scandal, the fact that testimony was given before Congress indicates that this is not just about one person in one post. This is a battle of factions within the American government structure.
And Dr. Jack Rasmus, to that point, Michael McKinley, a career diplomat and senior advisor to Pompeo, resigned from his post this week as resentment appears to be growing within the Department of State building. Your thoughts on all of this, Jack Rasmus?
Yeah, well, you know, what's different here is, ambassadors serve at the whim of the president, but what's different here is that the official ambassadors and representatives of the government are moved aside so we can have a rolling ambassador at large, Giuliani, and his minions and his shady bagmen to play the role of ambassadorship, right? So it's pretty clear there was a full court press to go after Biden, well over a year ago, thinking that he'd be, the opponent of Trump here. And, you get the official people out of the way so there's no leaks and they don't find out what the hell's going on. So it's not a typical let's get rid of one ambassador and replace him with my own. This is, even a sleazier deal here going on. But, folks should remember where all this begins. It begins in 2014 with the U.S. Neocons, the State Department, Virginia Nuland, who ran the State Department for Hillary for Eastern Europe, right, bragging after the, revolution there in 2014 that the U.S. spent $5 billion to overthrow that government. And then what happens, Nuland, who's a State Department official, coming out of the private equity firm, I forget the name of it, Capital something, in Chicago, she gets appointed as the economic minister of the Ukraine. Well, that opened the door to all the other financial vultures from the U.S. to, flood into the Ukraine. And on, one of those rafts, here comes the Bidens, I believe. There's a lot of smoking guns here. So, I think, who knows, we'll find out eventually whether the Bidens had their hand in something. But, this is the way capitalist politicians at the top work in both wings of the elite. And Trump smelled something here. I'm sure he's blackmailed a lot of other business people in his time. So, it's been a full court press to go after the Bidens, but he got caught.
Yeah.
Speaking of shady bagmen, two associates of Rudy Giuliani, and thank you very much, Dr. Jack Rasmus, for that wonderful transition. Speaking of shady bagmen, two associates of Rudy Giuliani connected to efforts to dig up dirt on Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden. They were arrested yesterday trying to leave the country and indicted on criminal charges for allegedly funneling foreign money into U.S. elections. Igor Fruman and Lev Parnas, we'll just call them Igor and Lev, were charged on Thursday with conspiring to make contributions in connection with federal elections in the names of others and with making false statements to and falsifying records to obstruct the administration of a matter within the jurisdiction of the Federal Elections Commission. This is according to the Department of Justice. Caleb Maupin, how bad is this, not just for Igor and Lev, but for Rudy as well?
Well, I want to put this in proper context because, I'm calling from New York City. I'm here in New York City. I'm on, in Midtown Manhattan doing this interview. And, Rudy Giuliani is a particularly interesting case, right? If you talk to your average New Yorker, everyone remembers Rudy Giuliani as, quote, cleaning up New York. And what that meant was hugely escalating the police presence in New York City. Rudy Giuliani was very much, when he came into office as, in a city that is very, very Democratic Party, coming in as not a Democrat, it was very much an upsurge. It was a power grab by the police department and by, local business owners, Wall Street guys, wealthy people that are in New York City and focused on New York City matters. And New York City, in many ways, people say it's the capital of capitalism, right? UN is here. Wall Street is here. This is very much an international city that all kinds of interests are here. But this, his rise to prominence was very much, a rising of local big money interests, local policing agencies, pushing some of these international interests that have a lot of influence in local politics here, pushing them aside and asserting the will of local wealthy folks and the policing agencies here. And, you know, when you talk about anti-globalism and this Trump thing and all of this, Giuliani, his career here kind of fits in with that. He represents one particular, you know, grouping in this city that was not particularly fond of the United Nations, not particularly fond of the big Wall Street banks in particular, though they loved the low-level Wall Street guys that are maybe taking only a million or two home every year. You know, it's complicated. There are conflicting interests here. And the fact that Giuliani has this relationship with Trump, the fact that Trump and now all this Ukraine stuff and you have to put all of this in the proper context. You know, New York City, I mean, Giuliani tried to be president of the United States, right? He tried to be America's mayor. We all remember that. And that you know, this city is very much, you know, a city that is very, very powerful internationally. But it's also a place that people live. It's also, there's a lot of local businesses here. There's a police department that's actually bigger than the army of most countries in the world. New York City is an entity unto itself, and there are conflicting interests here. And Giuliani's rise and his role in the Trump administration kind of indicates that. He's always been, you know, he's not in with the establishment necessarily. He's a complicated figure.
Jim Kavanaugh, your thoughts on Igor and Lev?
Igor and Lev, you know, are clearly out for themselves. They're both energy executives. They were trying to get curry favor with the Trump administration by making a big $325,000 donation in May, I think, of this year, of 2018, rather. You know, and they supposedly now, as I read this today, the details of this, is the issue is that they were trying to funnel foreign money into various places, not just to the Trump super PAC, which put that money, when the complaint was first made, sequestered that money and hasn't spent it. Okay, but they also put money into local campaigns in Florida and all around the world. They were trying to get money for a Russian billionaire to buy into some marijuana business, recreational marijuana business. So these guys are grifters who are out to make money, you know, buying influence from politicians. And the charges are that they are strawmanning money contributions from foreign entities and foreign individuals into American political campaigns. There's no charge that Giuliani had anything to do with, or that Trump had anything to do with this. This is, again, something that's standard operating procedure in U.S. politics. I guarantee 50,000 people have done the same thing. There's a lot of headlines about this because everybody's after Giuliani now, because Giuliani is a little rat-fighting politician, lawyer for Trump, and these guys are friends with Giuliani, and they went to Mar-a-Lago once. But this is not... There's no evidence I've seen that this has anything to do with any of the issues that are actually supposedly being used to impeach Trump. It's about these guys, corruption, and their hurting of campaign finances laws by funneling foreign money through shells and straw entities. So I don't know. I don't know the point of this politically is to have these headlines. Associated with Giuliani, and Giuliani is, of course, we know what he is. He's the guy going after Trump, and blah 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 blah. I don't know. That's what it's going to be. It's just not going to get Trump impeached.
Jack, they say a lot of times in court that circumstantial evidence can be more damning than direct evidence. Are they trying to develop a circumstantial case and trying to develop guilt by association with a lot of shady individuals and less than scrupulous operations, and through, I guess, attrition, death by a thousand cuts, that they're slowly trying to build a case, and I'll put case in quotation marks, air quotes, again, through inference and innuendo, that because they can't seem to put their finger on anything substantive.
Well, you know, these guys are sleazebag, white-collar financial lowlifes who do the dirty work at arm's length for the people, the elites, who are really the rich and powerful, you know, to keep it at arm's length so, you know, they don't, get their hands dirty. And these guys, if they get caught, are the ones who pay the price. But, you know, prosecutors, what they do, you know, whether they're official prosecutors or political prosecutors, you know, the strategy is to throw as much as you can of the stuff up against the wall, see what sticks. And maybe you can get one of these guys to turn and squeal, and you know, you got another direction you can go after the big boys who are behind the scene.
It also seems to me, in getting out on this particular subject, that because we're getting close to the 2020 election, that they're really trying to reiterate what so many people know about Donald Trump, and that he's an unscrupulous businessman. And it didn't work in 16, and if this is all they got, it's not going to work in 20. I've also been saying, and I think this will prove to be true, that the more time that they spend on this whole impeachment quest, Nancy Pelosi becomes the face of the process. She becomes the face of the Democratic Party. She's not running for president. So the longer she's on the front page with this impeachment thing, that's the less time that those that are vying for the Democratic presidential nomination will be able to articulate their policies and let people know what they stand for. I think the Democrats are rolling the dice here, and if they're rolling the dice, the House always wins. Hey, folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. This is Friday, so it's panel time, so we're very fortunate to have with us Dr. Jack Rasmus, Jim Kavanaugh, and Caleb Maupin. Keep it locked right here on Radio Sputnik. We're back, and you are tuned to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. It's Friday, so it's panel time, and we are fortunate to have Caleb Maupin, Jim Kavanaugh, and Dr. Jack Rasmus with us. Gentlemen, thank you, as always, so much for staying with me. Turkey launches offensive against U.S.-backed Syrian militia. Turkey is now in its third day of a ground and air assault against the Syrian militia, the Kurds, that has been a crucial American ally in the fight against ISIS. This is days after President Trump agreed to let the operation proceed. Dr. Jack Rasmus, how big of a mistake is this?
Well, mistake from whose perspective? I guess you gotta ask. The U.S. has had a number of false moves with regard to its relationships with Turkey here, and I think they're trying to mend fences at the expense of the Kurds. At least Trump is. You know, Turkey has showed signs of drifting towards Russia in terms of relationships. I wouldn't say in Russia's orbit, but certainly becoming more neutral. And this is a big issue for Turkey, and I think the U.S. knows it, so they're stepping aside and allowing it to happen. Of course, that's causing a firestorm within Republican interests in the Senate and elsewhere, who think that, how can you do this to an ally? The Kurds, but Turkey is potentially a more important ally than the Kurds.
Caleb, let me see if I have my geography somewhat correct here. Syria and Russia are allies. The Kurds have space in eastern Syria, I believe that is. And the Kurds were aligned with the United States. I can't imagine that Russia would be happy with that, but okay. And now the United States is abandoning its Kurdish ally. So I would think that the Kurds would then look to align themselves with Assad in Syria, which would make Russia happy. And if you're looking at it strictly from a United States point of view, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, it's more complicated than that, I would say.
Okay.
What happened here is that Trump put an end to a policy of the Obama administration that didn't really make a lot of sense, okay? You can either be aligned with Turkey or you can be aligned with the Kurds. You can't be aligned with both.
True.
He considers the Kurdish separatists, they've been fighting for years, to be terrorists, right? Now, there are these forces in Syria, they say they're completely different, have nothing in common with the PKK. In Turkey, completely separate organizations. That's the position of the United States. Turkey, it's got a border there, and it has a feeling that these forces that are fighting to create Kurdistan in Syria might be also the same forces that are fighting to create Kurdistan in Turkey. Turkey is a member of NATO. And at the beginning, if you'll recall, the beginning of the Syrian war, the Kurds, who had been fighting against Assad and have a record of opposing him and trying to fight for Kurdistan, they made a deal with Bashar Assad that basically they would align with the Syrian government and that they would have autonomy and that the Kurds would get control of their own region within Syria. And then the Kurds switched sides and went over to the United States. And at the time, Bashar Assad said, the United States is probably going to betray you and stab you in the back. Well, I mean, at this point, now we have a situation where Turkey, despite being a member of NATO, despite being a U.S. ally, is getting more and more friendly to Russia. And so it seems like as Turkey gets more friendly to Russia, but still has this relationship, Trump would really like to keep Turkey as close to the United States as possible. So he had to make a decision. Are we going to continue to align with the Kurds, or are we going to, you know, win some points with Turkey? And it seems that Trump made the decision to continue aligning with Turkey. And that's the situation here. And, there were only 50 troops in northeastern Syria, and they were almost human shields, basically. I mean, Turkey couldn't attack as long as there were U.S. troops there, because then it would be an attack on the United States. They were intermingled. Well, Trump pulled those troops out, and so now, you know, Turkey is moving ahead with its attack. I understand that the Kurds are in negotiations with the Syrian government, you know, trying to work out some kind of alliance once again. But the whole situation, you know, again, points to the chaos of the region. And I'm forced to think about some things that were written by, you know, Brzezinski, where he talked about, you know, keeping the barbarians killing each other as a geopolitical strategy. I'm forced to think about, you know, some things we've heard from Israeli politicians over the years. And it seems like everything is being done in that region to incite Sunni against Shia, Kurd against Arab, Persian against Arab. You know, any kind of division and any kind of sectarianism that can be fomented is being fomented. And it seems like, you know, giving the Kurds temporary support and then, you know, bringing it to an end. Again, this is a policy. What end did it serve for the United States? The State Department of the United States still officially considers the PKK, the Kurdish separatists in Turkey, to be a designated foreign terrorist organization. I mean, they're on the same list as Al-Qaeda and ISIS. But then a group that basically has the same ideology and you know, the same belief system, but just happens to be over the border in Syria, we're giving guns and weapons to, something's not right here, right? You know, I mean, the whole policy was very, very confused from the beginning. Trump seems to be trying on some level to make it make a little bit more sense, and he's trying to win Turkey, you know, closer to the United States, and probably, you know, stop the trajectory of Turkey getting closer and closer to Russia, which is happening, right? I mean, that's happening. Turkey is continuously getting closer to Russia, and there's negotiations going on, Iran, Turkey, Russia, you know, Syrian opposition. I mean, there's negotiations to try and bring this war to an end that are going on that Turkey is playing an important role in. This is all included in all of this, but the policy the United States had for so long, both supporting both its NATO ally in Turkey and the Kurds, was completely irrational. It seems like Trump is trying to make sense, make a policy that makes some consistent sense. That's my reading of this.
Jim Kavanaugh, chaos in the region. If we follow the money, who gets paid? Well, Lockheed Martin gets paid. Raytheon gets paid. General Electric, they make money through jet engines and other things. So there are a lot of American arms manufacturers that make an awful lot of money. The more chaos in the region that can be stirred up, and to Caleb's point, that this whole idea of controlled chaos has been at the forefront of American foreign policy, particularly in this region, for a very, very long time.
Yeah, well, you know, the splitting up of countries into three parts, not like Gaul, but, you know, was an American and Israeli policy with both Iraq and Syria in relation to the Kurds. And it was, we'll have a Sunni part, a Shia part, and the Kurds. And that way we'll break up these countries and have little ethno-nationalist enclaves. And Kurds, you know, the Kurds were a pawn in this game, and some of them played it very willingly. And as Caleb said, you know, they had an accommodation with the Syrian government that they broke by the goading of the Americans. And this is what happened to them. And this happened in 2016. Turkey invaded Syria during the Obama administration, and they were attacking the same forces that the Americans were protecting the day before the Americans were going to those forces and say, you got to get out of the way of the Turks. The Turks are coming. We got to let them come. The NATO ally is always going to be given preference over the Kurds. And the Kurds have made, they are being betrayed again because they're the little guys here.
And again, I think it's important real quick to reiterate betrayed again, because to Caleb's point, they have been betrayed a number of, I mean, historically betrayed.
Even in this context with America and Turkey, they were betrayed in 2016. They were furious that the Americans were allowing the Turks to come in. So now the Turks have been in, but they want to go further. And they want to. And you have this situation where eventually, and I've heard, I've seen some reports, that the political, the military leadership of the Kurds wants to make the deal with Damascus. But the political leadership is still saying, no, no, we've got to trust the United States. The United States cannot be trusted in this. And Donald Trump has shown that. But it's ultimately true. The United States is not there for the Kurds. The Kurds are pawns in the American game in Syria and Iraq.
And to the point about the United States fighting ISIS as it relates to Turkey, Turkey is more concerned about the PKK. That's a nationalist issue. ISIS is not. So if I think, and Caleb, help me out, if Erdogan has to make a decision, and it seems like he's made a decision, he's going to err on the side of eliminating the PKK because of the nationalist aspect, then ISIS is a secondary issue.
That's absolutely true, right? I mean, you know, PKK is something Erdogan considers to be a threat within his own borders. ISIS is not in his own borders at this time. So I think, yeah, I mean, that is a fair point to make.
One point that needs to be made regarding these Kurdish forces is, more than anything, the Kurdish fighters, you know, for decades have been motivated by Kurdish nationalism. And you know, the ideology has changed. At one point, they were pro-Soviet communists, then they became, you know, Maoists, and now they're calling themselves anarchists, I believe. But at the end of the day, they're fighting for Kurdish nationalism. That seems to be the motivation behind what they're fighting for. But I was a little bit shocked to see Meghan McCain describe them as fighting, quote, for America. Did you see that?
Yes.
It seems interesting that apparently in some foreign policy circles, the Kurds were basically viewed as a proxy of the U.S., of the United States. I mean, that's basically how they were being viewed. And that's why there's such outrage, is that these folks were basically being used as a proxy of the United States. That's intense, I think.
Let's take a quick pause here. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon here. This is the Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. And it's Friday. That means that it's panel time, and we're very fortunate to have with us Dr. Jack Rasmus, Jim Cavanaugh, and Caleb Maupin. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. It's Friday. That means it's panel time. We've got Jim Cavanaugh, Caleb Maupin, and Dr. Jack Rasmus with us, and we are just going to continue to forge ahead. We were just talking about Turkey launching an offensive against U.S.-backed, or formerly U.S.-backed, Kurdish militia. Now we have an Iranian tanker reportedly struck by missiles in the Red Sea. Dr. Jack Rasmus, is being reported that a pair of missiles hit an Iranian-flagged oil tanker steaming off the coast of Saudi Arabia in the Red Sea, causing an explosion and oil spill. Earlier today, the spill has been contained. The missiles were, quote unquote, possibly fired from Saudi soil, according to Shaheb Sadiq, head of the public relations of the National Iranian Tanker Company. This was told to Iranian Press TV. Iran has not offered any publicly available evidence that I can see for the incident. The ship is still moving and traveling south, according to tracking service Marine Traffic. No Iranian government officials have blamed the attack on any side at this stage. Dr. Jack Rasmus, your thoughts?
Well, I'm sure the Iranians did not fire on their own tanker, and I'm sure the American forces do not engage in that kind of stupid activity. But, you know, it's got to be something to do with Saudi Arabia, you know, probably an attempt to provoke Iran to do something again. And, you know, along the lines of drones attacking storage facilities or something like that. And that's probably why the Iranians haven't spoken up about it, because if they did, they would put themselves in a position that, they attacked you. Why don't you attack them? They're leaving the them out, probably purposely. They don't want to stir the pot anymore. But, you know, the more you can keep the pot going over there and things got a little calm after a while, the better it is for global oil prices. You know, it raises, every time there's an attack, it raises the cost of insurance on all the shipping in the area, which raises the price, which gives an opportunity to raise the crude price even further. So, I think it's probably an attempt by the Saudis to provoke the Iranians, who aren't taking the bait yet.
And Jim Cavanaugh, to that point, the U.S. is to send additional troops to Saudi Arabia to boost defenses against Iran. The Pentagon will deploy an additional 1,800 troops to Saudi Arabia, according to senior defense officials. They announced that today, which is an increase in the U.S. presence in the region, and it is being touted as a deterrent to aggressive Iranian action.
Well, you know, what they're doing is putting another Patriot missile battery in there and some more troops into Saudi Arabia. But again, that's a big problem. That's provoking the bear, putting American troops into Saudi Arabia. And the Patriot missiles didn't do so well against these drones. And they're not capable of actually dealing with these low-flying drones and cruise missiles in the same way as they are with ballistic missiles. But this is they have to do something. This is the general problem here is...
Wait a minute, Jim. When you say they have to do something, who's they?
The American neocons.
Oh, okay.
Okay? They have to show that they can fight back in some way without getting into a war. And, you know, my whole thing about this is where Trump's getting himself in trouble. His cancellation of that strike against Iran was one of the most extraordinary decisions I've ever seen a president make. And not a single one of the Democratic candidates, except for Bernie or Tulsi, would have dared done that. And they hate him for it. This is where he's going to get in trouble with Senate Republicans. He's not quick enough to pull the trigger. This week, and after that, after there was the attack on by the Houthis on the Saudi oil facilities, and Pompeo and the neocons said this was Iran, and it was an attack against us, he didn't fight back. Then, now this week, we're going to pull back the troops from Syria. They are furious about him, about not being militaristic enough in the Middle East. This Donald Trump is impeached. It'll be because Senate Republicans and the neocons behind them don't like that.
To that point, Jim, before I go to Caleb, are you saying that if the Democrats bring articles of impeachment out of the House, that there are Senate Republicans that would be so angry that Trump is not militaristic enough that they would vote against those articles of vote for those articles of impeachment?
I'm saying if we see Senate Republicans softening on Trump and voting for him, that will be the reason.
Okay.
That would be public in the articles of impeachment. Senate Republicans don't care about the phone calls with Galinsky or, you know, these corrupt politicians, businessmen hanging around Giuliani. But look at what Graham is saying about this. In fact, I saw a conservative commentator yesterday, a blogger, who said Lindsey Graham is saying that he will protect Trump if he attacks Iran.
Mm-hmm. And right now he's saying that moving out of Syria was one of the biggest mistakes that he could make. Caleb Maupin, the new deployments, these additional 1,800 troops taken together with others authorized within the last month, boost the number of U.S. troops in the Middle East by about 3,000. An additional 14,000 troops have been deployed in the region since the spring. And your thoughts, Caleb Maupin, and your thought particularly in that it's been alleged an Iranian tanker has been fired upon and Iran is still showing patience and they're showing control.
Well, I must say this silliness with the oil tankers in the Persian Gulf or, you know, now in the Red Sea or in Gibraltar. I mean, this is starting to get a little bit predictable. Follow the oil price. The oil price is staying, you know, I mean, we're above $50 a barrel, but it's artificially there. I mean, it's not meant to be there. And so every time it is starting to dip, all of a sudden there's another incident, and then we're back up safe above $50 a barrel again, $58. This is...
And I think you said this, if not last week, you said this the week before.
And I probably sound in archaic terminology like a broken record.
No. I'm saying that you're consistent and you're right.
I mean, and these incidents are, I mean, you know, in some cases there's an incident, they're blaming it on Iran. In some cases we have an Iranian vessel that gets seized. Now we have an Iranian vessel that's been attacked. I mean, what's next? Next, is there going to be another Saudi oil field blown up? Is there going to be another U.S. or Japanese oil tanker that's doing business with Iran getting attacked? I mean, it's starting to be almost predictable. You know, the oil price starts to dip, and then there's an incident regarding Iranian oil tankers or Iranian ships or Saudi ships or flamed on Iran in the Gulf region. I mean, it's really kind of predictable, and it's bizarre, you know, and you don't want to be too much of a conspiracy theorist, but it seems to be a pretty clear pattern over the past, you know, several months.
Let's move to the final issue of the week. The president has not had a very good day in court. Appeals court rules against Trump in fight with Congress over president's accounting firm records. Congress can seek 8 years of Trump's business records from his accounting firm. A federal appeals court in Washington ruled today in one of several legal battles over access to the president's financial data. In a 2-1 ruling, the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit upheld Congress's broad investigative powers and rejected the president's bid to block lawmakers from subpoenaing the documents. The judges ruled that Trump's arguments that the subpoenas were invalid because Congress lacked a legitimate legislative purpose was incorrect. In fact, contrary to the president's arguments, the committee possesses authority under both the House rules and the Constitution to issue the subpoena, and Mazars must comply. That is what two of the judges said, both of whom were Democratic appointees. And another judge rules against Trump on border wall. Federal judge ruled against Trump's unorthodox plan to use billions of dollars in federal funds to extend the wall on the Mexican border, despite Congress's refusal to appropriate money for that purpose. Dr. Jack Rasmus, the president didn't have a good day in court.
Yeah, but it's in courts that are overseen by judges appointed by Democrats.
That's true. And these will be appealed.
Yeah, and he'll let it go to his Supreme Court. You know, that's his court now. And I don't think that disturbs him all that much. He'll get some Republican court to offer a contrary opinion, and it'll go to the Supreme Court. And, you know, as far as getting at his tax returns and stuff like that, I think his appointees to the Supreme Court, you know, the Gorsuches and Kavanaughs, will side with him on that, and that'll be that.
Jim Kavanaugh, Roberts has not proven to be the dependable, reliable rubber stamp of approval that many thought that he would be. And here we're talking about some very fundamental constitutional, constructional issues in terms of oversight. Your thought, to Jack's point, that it'll go to the Supreme Court and it'll be found held in favor of Trump because he has nominated and had approved Gorsuch and Kavanaugh.
Well, that's a reasonable assumption, but you know, these are issues of constitutional interpretation that really are open both ways. You know, and again, whatever decided about this, the other side's going to use it at some point. You know, what the Trump people are saying: vote for an impeachment inquiry, and then you have the authority to do this. But just on the oversight committee, you shouldn't be doing this. There is a it's not a constitutional law, but there is a generally held principle that you can't have criminal proceedings against the president. I don't know whether that's constitutional or not, but if you're going to do it, it's going to do it for one guy. The other party is going to come in and do it to you. I remember very clearly. I remember this right after Watergate, I saw a documentary about the Army-McCarthy hearings. And McCarthy was there, and they stopped McCarthy with Eisenhower with claims of executive privilege. And McCarthy was there with Bobby Kennedy sitting behind him, who was his lawyer, saying, you start using this executive privilege. You, what are you doing? You can't do that. We have the right to investigate. Okay. When it came to the Watergate hearing, the Democrats turned around, or the liberals turned around and says, oh, you can't use executive. They were giving the McCarthy line. We should be able to investigate. Now you have the arguments coming from all sides right now. And you investigate without an impeachment vote or in some oversight committee where you don't have the right to call witnesses, you don't have the right to cross-examine, or is it unreasonable?
Let me stop you there because I need to get Caleb in on this. U.S. District Court Judge David Briones said that he made it clear that a January budget measure ending a partial government shutdown, that border wall funding was being denied beyond the $1.3 billion for upgrades. He said the congressional language in the bill reveals Congress's intent to limit the border barrier funding. And we know that revenue bills come out of the House. This is Congress's purview. Again, I think a fairly clear constitutional issue. Your thoughts, Caleb Maupin?
You know, as was said before, you know, this is the kind of thing, it's a lot like the filibuster. You know, I mean, the forces that were defending the filibuster, when they're out of power, when they don't have a majority, all of a sudden, you know, they want to keep the filibuster. And then when the other side is in power, these are constitutional maneuvers. These are points of constitutional law and procedure. But at the end of the day, everyone wants to be able to do as much as they can when they're in power and have the other side do as little as they possibly can when they're in power. And the question of what is constitutional, I think, is secondary to, is it my agenda that is up or the other guy?
Yeah, but there's another underlying tension here, and that is the tension between the executive branch and the legislative branch. And the executive branch is always trying to exert more power, and the legislative branch is always trying to push back. So I do understand the political elements of this, in that the Republicans and the filibuster issue is a perfect example, but I think there's an even deeper contention, and that is the contention between, and it's been a historic contention, between the executive branch and the legislative branch. Gentlemen, I gotta thank you. That was a phenomenal, phenomenal show today. Dr. Jack Rasmus, Jim Kavanaugh, and Caleb Maupin. Gentlemen, thank you all very much for your time and your generosity as you are with us on Fridays. Folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here next week on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.